and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm John Kiriakou, and I'm joined in studio by co-host Brian Becker. In this hour, we take a look at the news of the day. First, House Republicans are proposing another stopgap spending measure that would ignore Democratic concerns over DACA, but would fund the Children's Health Insurance Program, or CHIP, for the next 6 years. Next, for 16 years, fighting in Afghanistan between U.S. troops and the Taliban has stopped when winter descends. Under the new rules of engagement, the U.S. and Afghan forces conducted an average of 15 airstrikes a day this December, compared with an average of 2 last December. Then, the value of the dollar is down more than 15% versus the euro in the past 6 months, making exports cheaper and imports more expensive. But it also could fuel inflation and artificially prolong the stock market rally. And then, momentum is building for the outdoor Virginia prison reform rally to be held from 2 to 3 p.m. on Saturday, January 20th, at the Bell Tower on Capitol Square in Richmond, Virginia. And finally, on the same day that he refused to answer questions before the House Intelligence Committee, former White House senior advisor Steve Bannon was subpoenaed to testify before special counsel Robert Mueller's grand jury. He has now reportedly agreed to an interview with Mueller rather than testify. That's all coming up next on Loud and Clear. But first, we turn to the possible government shutdown. House Republicans are proposing another stopgap spending measure that would ignore Democratic concerns over DACA, but would fund the Children's Health Insurance Program, or CHIP, over the next 6 years. We'll look at whether the Democrats will be forced to choose children over immigrants to get a budget deal. We're joined from Pittsburgh by Dr. Scott Tyson. He's the CEO of Pediatrics South and an advocate for the right to health care. Dr. Tyson, welcome to the show.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So we're hearing breaking news that the Republicans may rally within their own caucus behind an idea to essentially strip Obamacare of its ability to raise revenue in exchange for a temporary budget deal. To tell you the honest to God's truth, I've never seen a political party in my life, Brian, that worked so hard to take people's health care away from them.
Right.
It's something that I don't understand. Dr. Scott Tyson, I'd love to hear your thoughts.
Oh, I mean, I agree with you completely. This is, first of all, I'm an advocate of improved Medicare for all. So I'm probably to the left of anybody that's in there except for John Conyers right now. Having said that, CHIP is one of the most critical programs for working parents who cannot afford health care for their children. These are working people, and we're talking about 9 million children. So just follow the logic of this. What's going to happen with those kids if they lose their coverage? They're going to avoid health care. They're going to end up in the emergency rooms where either the hospitals are going to absorb the cost or the families are going to have to absorb the cost, which ends up in very frequently medical bankruptcy. They're going to get care that may be too late for very, very simple things to take care of. And the idea of you know, saying, okay, we'll either get rid of 800,000 kids who've been here who don't even know the country of origin. I mean, they know what it is, but
those are the dreamers. Those are the dreamers.
Yeah, exactly. They have no idea of functioning in those countries or on the backs of healthcare. We have enough for the military to increase the military budget, but we don't have enough to pay for healthcare for children. This should be criminal. I mean, it really should be criminal.
It is criminal. There's no other way to describe it. And, you know, the thing is, in all the other advanced, meaning industrial countries in the world, This would not even be a right-left issue.
Oh, no. And these other countries, frankly, are appalled that we even have these debates.
That's exactly right. I just read a study that showed that since 2011, Norway, that, you know, Trump said we will take all people from Norway. Who the heck from Norway is going to come over here when they've got what they have over there? Norway, Denmark, Taiwan, Sweden. How many medical bankruptcies did they have in those countries from 2011 to 2016?
I would
None.
Guess zero.
How many did we have in our country? 4 million. And these are people, usually 75% have insurance. So this is... that we should not even be discussing whether the people of the United States should have access to affordable, quality health care. And yet we are. You're absolutely right. We're the only industrialized country that doesn't have it, and we pay twice as much as any other country for our health care per capita. What is wrong with that picture?
What happens if this bill doesn't pass? In other words, the Republicans are doing this as a maneuver, saying to the Democrats or trying to rally their own ranks, we'll have a bill that will pass that will gut Obamacare, Affordable Care Act, or the main revenue source for it. We'll also make sure that there's no relief for the 800,000 to a million people who came as young kids that you're mentioning, who are part of the DREAM Act. We're not going to do that. But we will provide these 9 million kids with healthcare funding through the CHIP program. But what if it doesn't pass? Because it looks to me like it might not pass. There's a lot of pressures. So the government will shut down. But what will actually happen to the CHIP program? What happens to these 9 million kids?
I mean, your guess is as good as mine. I mean, it is very possible that these children will have no insurance. So today, insurance in the United States is equated with health care. So these kids will not get health care. And I mean, the issue is many of these kids have chronic diseases. Many of these kids are on chemotherapeutic agents. You know, you remember the famous line that George Bush said, well, everybody can get health care. They can just go to an emergency room. Well, when was the last time you saw somebody with a malignancy go to an emergency room and get their chemotherapy? It doesn't happen. It can't happen. So, I mean, it could be a catastrophic system. I mean, it could be a just complete collapse of the system. And so the problem is that the Republicans don't have any answers to any of the questions that we ask them of, like, what are you going to do with these 9 million children? So it is a shame and a blot on the United States. And the world is looking at us and saying, how could you do this? And we're asking the same question. How could we do this?
Rich, very rich, and they're almost all very rich, mostly men, political figures who have Cadillac health plans, and even if they didn't, they have enough money that they can do it. They're sentencing children with cancer, and we always get those ads on TV, helps a kid with cancer. They're actually sentencing these kids who are dependent on chemotherapeutic and other cancer drugs. They're sentencing them to death. Let's just call it by its name. This is a death sentence for children by rich politicians because it's expedient for them politically.
That's exactly right. And it plays to a base that is it's a base that's base. I mean, let's call a spade a spade. I really liked what the other guy said about how this is rich white men who are doing this. If we had a representation of what our population really is, we would have, 50%+ women in office. We would have people of color. We would have
poor people,
gay, lesbian, LGBT, poor people.
Half the country is either in or near poverty. Like, there's no poor people in Congress. They're not represented in Congress.
Absolutely not. And you know, they go into Congress. I just read an article that I can't remember who it was, but I should remember who it was. But went in 2007, didn't have any money. Now is coming out with $45 million. I mean, wouldn't you like to have gone from 2007 to 2016, 2017, 18 with $45 million? I mean, what did you do during that time that got you the $45 million? So I don't think we can speak strongly enough to say this is disgusting and we should be ashamed of ourselves for even considering this.
You know, it's absolutely astounding to me, too, because this isn't being done in secret, right? The Republicans aren't trying to strip people of their health care in secret. This is being played out on the front page of every paper in America.
Right.
And people aren't in the streets over this.
And that brings me to another question. The Democrats also seem to be playing politics with this because even though they're not the majority, they have vast resources. I think if the Democratic Party leadership said to people, look, it's criminal to deprive 9 million kids of health care as part of a political thing, come to Washington, have a demonstration of a million people for children's health care. I bet you a million people would come.
I agree with you. I think that the Republicans are disgusting. The Democrats should be ashamed of themselves because they are not stepping up to the plate and saying, This is absurd. What we need to do is get our base rallied and move them into Washington and say enough is enough. We, as the wealthiest country in the world, have the ability to provide improved Medicare for all, universal health care to every one of our people who live in this country, and we're not doing it. We should be ashamed of ourselves. You know, there's a bill that provides universal health care, improved Medicare for all, H.R. 676. There's 115 signatories from the Democratic Party, obviously, on that bill. Only two list it on their website as support. The Democrats are leading by kind of avoiding and kind of trying to work around the edges. They should be ashamed of themselves. The Republicans are disgusting, but the Democrats need to step up to the plate.
Well, this is a conversation that I think we're going to have to devote a lot more time to in the near future. Unfortunately, we are out of time. We were joined from Pittsburgh by Dr. Scott Tyson. He's the CEO of Pediatric South there in Pittsburgh and an advocate for the right to health care. Thank you for joining us. In the meantime, you're listening to Loud and Clear. Please stay tuned. We will be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
For 16 years, fighting in Afghanistan between U.S. troops and the Taliban has stopped when winter descends. Under the new rules of engagement for the third U.S. president to administer the Afghanistan war, the U.S. and Afghan forces conducted an average of 15 airstrikes a day this December, compared with an average of 2 last December. We're joined from Vancouver, Canada, by Anne Wright. Anne is a retired U.S. Army colonel and former U.S. State Department official in Afghanistan, who resigned in protest of the invasion of Iraq and became a noted anti-war activist. Anne, it's always great to have you on.
Thank you. It's great to be with you both.
Anne, this seems to be a major step up in military operations after all these years. You know, the U.S. military almost never did any fighting in December, and now every other day there's an airstrike. What do you make of this?
Well, the airstrikes are easy. That's what I make of it. They certainly aren't going to send ground forces out in the middle of the winter, as the Afghans don't do either. It's been kind of the tried and true rule. You don't go out and freeze yourself in those very harsh climates of Afghanistan. But it's very easy for the United States to send its bombers from all over the world, really, to bomb in Afghanistan. I mean, it's almost like a practice round. You know, our military wants to do a lot of practicing, and these air crews need practice. And so they can fly bombers in from any point in the world, really, with refueling, and then just drop the bombs anywhere on Afghanistan and then fly back home. And they don't get cold. They don't have to go tromping around in the snow. And I think that's really what we're seeing there.
There's another major change in this policy, Brian and Ann. It says here, the huge spike, I'm reading from the Washington Post, the huge spikes in airstrikes is the product of new rules of engagement adopted as part of a strategy that President Trump announced in August. U.S. forces can now strike Taliban targets at will, whereas under the Obama administration, they were restricted to defending Afghan forces under imminent attack. As more than a half dozen U.S. military officers put it, the gloves are off. So the gloves are off finally after 16 years, but does taking the gloves off really make any kind of difference on the ground?
Well, I think it does. And when you have bombings, the indiscriminate deaths of civilian population, I mean, they may say they're going after Taliban. They may get a few militant Talibans, but as we've seen in the past, the statistics are that they get a lot of innocent civilians when they're using this indiscriminate bombing. So I would say that the gloves are off, all right, but it's the civilians said better watch out because they're going to be a lot of civilian deaths because of this change in policy.
During the Vietnam War, Lyndon Johnson, who had been committed to the war on poverty, to the Civil Rights Act, to the Voting Rights Act, became obsessed with the body count, the count of the enemy dead every day. That's what he wanted to hear, first and foremost. How many of the enemy did we kill? And I remember vividly as a teenager, and all of us who were teenagers were getting ready to make the decision, are we going to go into the military? Are we going to go to Vietnam? So it became a pressing question, made you really pay attention to the news. The idea was that if enough American planes could bomb enough Vietnamese towns and villages, the U.S. would win the war. Well, the body count was very, very high. Millions of Vietnamese probably did die, but it doesn't win the war. It does create an ocean of misery and a cycle of violence and a cycle where people want vengeance because their villages have been bombed from planes that they can't see high up in the sky. It's not a winning strategy, Enright, but maybe America doesn't care about winning right now. Maybe there's no real goal to this except just maintaining a constant military presence and using Afghanistan as a cruel training ground, as you're suggesting.
Well, indeed. And when you see the response from people in Afghanistan to the military operations that have been going on for 16 years now, there are more U.S. soldiers killed by those people that we have trained. Those people that are in the Afghan army and Afghan police, they kill more of our own soldiers than the Taliban do. And it is a direct result of the presence of the United States and the bombing of these villages. Many of the villages that, from which these the Afghan army and the Afghan police come from. So and I can't figure out why the Pentagon didn't quite realize that and make the connection that the numbers of U.S. military that are killed are not by the Taliban. It's by our own people. And as you bring up Vietnam, it's very interesting there. You know, the increased bombing, as Lyndon Johnson started saying, we've got to, you know, we're going to bomb them into submission. And that area along the DMZ in North Vietnam, or on the Vietnam DMZ, was the most heavily bombed area. They say that more bombs were dropped in that area, the two provinces along the DMZ, than were dropped in Europe in World War II. And the Vietnamese are still having to deal with exploding ordnance even now. Our Veterans for Peace national organization is helping with training Vietnamese to defuse these things. In fact, our VFP national group is going to Vietnam next month, and we'll be there. We'll go up and see the demining operations, also Agent Orange assistance that we're giving to Vietnamese, and we will also be at My Lai, where hundreds of Vietnamese were massacred, purposely murdered by U.S. troops. So we'll be there as a delegation of U.S. veterans saying, we are sorry for what our government did to you.
And I want to ask you about the issue of mission creep. You know, everybody knows that when the U.S. first went into Afghanistan, it was ostensibly to destroy al-Qaeda. Well, by early 2002, al-Qaeda was destroyed. And even by the middle of 2002, a Senate Foreign Relations Committee report said that there were fewer than 50 al-Qaeda members left in Afghanistan. But then the mission became to attack the Haqqani network and then the Taliban. And now I'm looking at today's Washington Post, which has a very graphic video of a U.S. Air Force fighter jet bombing what it's calling a Taliban drug lab. So it's bombing a narcotics lab. Now, the Taliban, of course, makes a great deal of its money by cultivating heroin poppy and then processing the heroin and then selling it overseas, mostly in Iran and Russia. But this is one of those cases where you use a $100,000 bomb to blow up a $1,000 poppy processing lab. And certainly you can process poppy into heroin in anybody's kitchen. Is this something that we ought to be getting used to, that we're going to be now going after the Taliban drug trade? Is this a change in policy? Is this smart? Is it not smart?
Well, you know, it's interesting that the Taliban is now using drug money to support its operations, because in the beginning, when the Taliban took over from the warlords, they did not use that. In fact, they were totally against this whole drug thing.
Yeah, in fact, in the year 2000, there was literally no heroin poppy that was processed in Afghanistan. The Taliban were staunchly opposed to heroin. We have 2 minutes left. Go right ahead.
Yes, and then we see that for every year the United States has been in Afghanistan, the poppy production has increased. And so now that the Taliban has seen, well, this is easy money for us, and since the Taliban has expanded its control over much greater region of Afghanistan, I mean, after 16 years, the United States and the Afghan government has lost an enormous amount of territory. The southern part of the country is now in Taliban hands.
Completely in Taliban hands.
So what's 16 years?
Yeah.
Yeah.
We have about a minute and a half. We're coming up on the one-year anniversary, and right, of the dropping of the so-called mother of all bombs. That's the Massive Ordnance Air Blast, the GBU-43B bomb, 21,000-pound bomb. And that was just for demonstration purposes. But just think about what that would mean. Well, I want the audience to think about what that would mean if somewhere in this country, the country, our country, another government came and dropped a 21,000-pound bomb, a bomb that kills all living things like within a square mile. Why did the Pentagon do it?
Well, they said they only had three of them. They wanted to test it and, you know, testing it on other people. And that's where you had a spike in the number of U.S. military that were killed on military installations by Afghan soldiers and police. After that bomb was dropped, the numbers of Americans that got killed, because Afghans were saying, how dare you do this? How dare you use this huge bomb on us? So it's not that the people are necessarily appreciative of what the Taliban's doing, but they sure as heck do not want their country to be used as the testing bed for U.S. military weapons.
Yeah, we're going to leave it right there. We've been joined from Vancouver by Anne Wright. Anne, why don't you, in the last 30 seconds, tell us why you're in Vancouver, Canada?
I'm part of a 15-woman international delegation. We've been here to try to press the foreign ministers of the UN Command Korea countries to have dialogue, not maximum pressure by military operations and a naval quarantine and sanctions on North Korea. Let's have dialogue and discussion, not war games.
Yeah, the Pentagon is fearing that peace might actually break out on the Korean Peninsula, but I want to salute you and the other people there for doing what you are doing. We've been joined from Vancouver, Canada by Anne Wright. She is a retired U.S. Army colonel and a former U.S. State Department official in Afghanistan. She resigned in protest of the invasion of Iraq in 2003 and has become a noted anti-war activist. You're listening to Loud and Clear. After a short break, we'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
The value of the dollar is down more than 15% versus the euro in the past 6 months, making exports cheaper and imports more expensive. It also could fuel inflation and prolong the stock market rally. But is this a bubble? And are the Trump administration's policies just kicking the can down the road? We're joined from San Francisco by Daniel Sankey. He's a financial policy analyst. And we're joined from Amsterdam by Steve Keen, the author of Debunking Economics and the World's First Crowdfunded Economist. You can check out his work at Patreon.com/Prof. Steve Keen, K-E-E-N. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Daniel, let's start with you. Just as an overall notion, is a weaker dollar better for the United States? Does it put more people to work?
So the Trump administration, you know, got elected to office with a promise to bring manufacturing back to America and to bring jobs by bringing manufacturing back to the United States. And so a weak dollar actually has a benefit to companies that export in the United States. So for countries to purchase U.S.-produced goods, they need to purchase it in dollars. And if they exchange whatever currency they use, whether it's euros or yen or whatever it might be, they have to exchange more of them to be the equivalent of a single dollar if the dollar is especially strong, and they have to convert more of them. But if the dollar is weak, then they have to convert less of their money. So effectively, it becomes cheaper for those foreign nations to purchase U.S. goods. The dollar, when it's very strong, makes U.S. exports very expensive, and therefore U.S. manufacturing suffers. So part of what the Trump administration is saying, the dollar is too strong, we might consider devaluing it, is in that bid to bring back manufacturing jobs. But there's a lot of complexity and downstream effects in terms of how a weak dollar also impacts investments, impacts prices for what we pay for foreign goods. In other words, it increases how much we have to pay for foreign goods. And as you know, the vast majority of the day-to-day goods working people buy are produced in other countries. So there's a lot of complexity to it. But right now, you know, he's playing to his promise to bring manufacturing back, and that's a big part of why he's considering a weak dollar to be an improvement.
Steve Keen, is Trump or the Trump administration responsible for the devaluation of the dollar in relationship to the euro or other international currencies?
There's two sides to an exchange rate valuation, and the euro has been weak, growing weakly compared to the United States for some time, courtesy of their austerity policies under the Maastricht Treaty. So it's probably more likely Europe weakening itself rather than America necessarily strengthening itself at the same time. But there's an overall context I want to keep in mind as well, and that is that, you know, Trump has always been about making good deals and bad deals. Well, one of the worst deals America ever made was demanding that it become a reserve currency back at the Bretton Woods Agreement, because the proposal on the table from Keynes was to form an international currency belonging to no country called the Bancor. And the Americans, you know, beating their chests after helping win the Second World War, said, oh, we're the strongest country, we want to use the American dollar. Well, that was a stupid deal, because what it meant that every country in the world, if it wanted to trade, needed American dollars. There was a necessary demand for American dollars just to be able to take place in trade, and that demand wouldn't have been there if the Bancor had existed. Well, that means the American dollar has always been overvalued compared to what it would be if it was simply one of the national currencies trading with a common international currency. That was a stupid piece of chest beating by the Americans. We're King Kong, but it's turned them into monkeys in international trade. So whatever fall you might see like now, like a 15% fall, that's only partially compensating for the massive overvaluation the American dollar actually has because they made the stupid mistake of wanting to be the reserve currency.
Daniel Sankey, what's your opinion on that? Because obviously U.S. policymakers, in addition to the chest-thumping phenomena that comes with victory, they obviously had a strategic orientation that this would in some ways force the world to function as a subsidiary of American banking, no?
Yes, exactly. So the reason why one of the reasons why the U.S. pushed for the dollar to become a reserve currency is to force a massive influx of foreign capital into the U.S. dollar and into U.S. Treasury investments, which is actually a big part of how we finance a lot of our deficit and a lot of other things in the U.S. besides. So the intention was for banks that are based in the U.S. that are using the U.S. dollar to get an outsized influence in the global market by forcing everyone to have to kind of play by their currency or play by their rules, if you want to put it that way. So while it's true there are all kinds of hurtful effects for working people and certainly for the little guy when the dollar is the reserve currency, it also forces the U.S. to become involved in economies across the world and become involved in military conflicts therein because it's all bound up in our economy through the dollar. So there's that. It increases militarism and imperialism that way. But it also increases the banks and it gives them an outsized weight and an outsized power in the United States and forces an influx of capital. So there was some real intentionality when they made the dollar the reserve currency. They knew this would happen, and that was in part their goal, especially for those politicians and legislators that were kind of in the pockets of the banking industry at the time.
Steve Keen, the Fed has been struggling to fend off deflation. The Treasury Department has been printing as much money as it can to try to keep growth steady. How long can a policy like that be maintained? Is there a downside to it?
This is one of the reasons that all this talk about debt and deficits at the government level is unfortunately nonsense that maintains part of the insane financial situation we're in right now, because there's no limit on the amount of American dollars that the Federal Reserve can create. Literally no limit. It's only whether they're accepted at the other side. And, of course, nobody as yet has rejected an American dollar when it's deposited in their accounts. So because they can continue financing this, they could do QE forever. Now, what they're actually going to do, in my opinion, is they believe they have finally got enough inflation to feel like they've got the economy back to the roughly 2% rate they think is normal. They think the unemployment rate has fallen down to about something in the order of 4 or 5%, which they say is full inflation. They think the economy is growing at about 3%, so therefore they want to get back to an interest rate of about 4%. And as part of that, they're also going to start unwinding QE. Now, I think both those are going to backfire massively on both the stock market and the American currency, because when they start to unwind QE, that will mean all the financial corporations that purchased that sold bonds to the government and then had money they would then put into the stock market, which massively boosted the stock market, they will then be going in the reverse direction, selling stocks to buy the bonds that the government's trying to sell back to them. And I think that'll take the wind out of the stock market. And that should be rather interesting to see how the orange person reacts to that particular phenomenon.
Okay, Daniel Sankey, we have about 3 minutes left, a little bit less than 3 minutes. Again, these are complicated, interconnected, and contradictory phenomena because, of course, everything in the business world and in finance is transactional. So what's good for one might be bad for the other. There's not all around win-win-win, to use the Chinese formulation. What do you agree with Steve Keen's hypothesis?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that a lot of the economic data they're relying on is just, you know, frankly dishonest. When they talk about the employment rate being at 5%, you know, how we calculate the employment rate is crazy. If I mow my neighbor's lawn this week and get paid $10, I'm not unemployed anymore. So the employment rate is buoyed up by part-time jobs, by people working 3 part-time jobs, by labor that is grossly underpaid. So the idea that somehow this low employment rate is beneficial or a sign the economy is strong is completely misleading. And I agree with Professor Steve Keen. You know, these economists do this every time and these policymakers do it every time. They think, oh, we're in good shape. We'll just pull it back. Well, this huge stock market rally that we've seen it hitting new highs as recently as this week that it's never hit before, it's all been buoyed up by, you know, U.S. government financing, by quantitative easing, by a low interest rate, and by all these artificial means as opposed to real economic growth. So I agree with Professor Keen that if they do start rolling this back, and they probably will, that we'll see a sudden bursting of the bubble in the stock market for sure.
It's been almost 11 years since the recession. That's a long time to go without a major economic contraction. At the beginning of every news cycle, when the economy is recovering, there's cheap credit or easy credit that fuels, investment, it fuels speculation in the stock market. Nonetheless, it creates economic activity. Steve Keen, are we heading towards, in the short term, a major economic contraction or something akin to what might have happened or did happen in 2007, 2008?
No, I think what's more likely is what the Japanese have been through, because America's turned Japanese by doing precisely the same thing, letting a speculative bubble drive up private debt to enormous levels, giving a credit bubble in the process that at its peak was generating demand equivalent to 15% of America's GDP. That then plunged to -6 during the financial crisis. That's what actually caused the crisis. This time round, credit's only running at about 6 or 7% of GDP, and it already appears to be trending down. And I think when the government, when the Fed starts to put rates up and they try to take QE away, that will actually fall. People will then be forced back into deleveraging or head back towards private sector deleveraging, and that'll cause a minor slump. But it won't be anything like falling from +15 to -6. And that's why I call these economies that have made this mistake of letting private debt bubbles occur the walking dead of debt. They'll never have enough credit demand to it being anything other than apparent zombies. And any recovery will be short-lived and you'll go back into stagnation again.
The night of the living dead,
it's,
zombie
it's coming.
World.
It's coming.
But interesting, very interesting. In other words, what Steve Keen is projecting is not necessarily a major sort of depression,
no.
But protracted stagnation, the zombie walk.
That's right. And we saw it in Japan, and it lasted a long time.
Maybe, is Steve Keen, in the last 10 seconds, is it still happening in Japan?
Yeah, I know. Japan's back in a bit of credit revival, but they're stuck at much the same level as America. So being a walking dead a bit is a global phenomenon.
All right.
Right. Well, thank you both, gentlemen. We were joined from San Francisco by Daniel Sankey. Daniel is a financial policy analyst, and Professor Steve Keen, the author of Debunking Economics and the World's First Crowdfunded Economist, joined us from Amsterdam. You can check out his work at patreon.com/Prof. Steve Keen. Gentlemen, thank you. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Loud and clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Momentum is building for the outdoor Virginia Prison Reform Rally to be held from 2 to 3 p.m. on Saturday, January 20th, at the Bell Tower on Capitol Square in Richmond, Virginia. We're joined from Richmond by Margaret Breslaw, chairperson of the Coalition for Justice. Margaret, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Margaret, this is a really important event, at least it is for me, and I know anybody interested in liberty and in fairness and justice is going to want to hear the details of this event. Can you tell us what's happening?
Well, what makes this rally so special and unusual is that it was prisoner-led, conceived, initiated. So Coalition sponsors an organization of prisoner activists called VAPOC, Virginia Prisoner of Conscience. And in talking to prisoners, they really saw the need to have a rally in Virginia around the time of the Virginia General Assembly. There's a lot of new legislative effort, several reform bills that were being introduced. So they said, you know, we really have to do this. So several months back, we did something that I think was a first in the state, possibly the country. We had prisoners call in to a statewide conference call. Anyone could join that call. And we did get responses, responders on that call from throughout the state. And it was prisoners themselves that talked about the issues of mass incarceration, that talked about issues specific to Virginia. So it was the first time you really heard a prisoner point of view. So the next step was, what do we do? And it was collectively decided that we have a rally because really those issues have to be heard. There are a lot of new delegates. It's an interesting time to be running for office. There are new voices emerging, new interest, especially in criminal justice reform. So we facilitated the rally, and it is still prisoners' voices that will be distinctively heard at that rally. So we'll have statements from prisoners. Every day I get two or three more statements coming in from prisoners incarcerated throughout the state with something to say. And I think that's what makes us different. And I think it'll be extraordinary, really.
You have a Facebook page, too, that I'm looking at right now that is chock full of great information. If people go to facebook.com, search for Virginia Prison Reform Rally, this information pops right up, lots of details. I have to say that I'm struck by the number of co-sponsors you have. It's really impressive.
And actually, there would have been more. We just didn't have time to, you know, we're pulling this rally together because we, you know, there are all sorts of logistics, as you know, in organizing a rally. And some groups simply didn't have the time to meet with their own organizations and officially endorse the rally. But what has amazed me is the event has been shared, and it's been shared by prison reform groups as far away as California and Georgia. So this is an issue. Mass incarceration affects us all in every state. So I think there's a push right now. It's really quite phenomenal.
I think one of the things many Virginians don't understand, or perhaps they're too young to even remember, but Virginia has no parole. If you're sentenced to a length of time, you do that length of time. There's almost no incentive to behave while you're in prison because you're just simply not getting out any earlier than you otherwise would. You make a point in the details on this Facebook page that it costs Virginia taxpayers $79.28 per day per prisoner. We have academic studies up to our necks that prove that rehabilitation costs less than half that. And so we're bankrupting our state and overtaxing our citizens by contributing to this mass incarceration.
Yeah. And what's happening is, you know, once you're locked up and the keys thrown away, your prison population can only grow. So what's happening is that, you know, prisons are reaching their maximum capacity or over capacity, and they're still filling up, and there's just no way out. And I think that with the truth and sentencing laws that was put in by then Governor George Allen as part of a get tough on crime in 1995, what they did was they decided that they're going to double the time for what quote unquote violent felons serve in prison. So what that meant was they said, oh, well, somebody gets 20 years, but, you know, with parole, they might get out in 10. So they did this truth in sentencing. So they doubled time. Now, look, there's other problem Virginia has is that the threshold for a felony is $200.
That's right.
So you can only imagine, you know, taxpayer for something that somebody stole, like a cell phone or something, whatever, $200. They're going to jail. They're going to prison. And it's costing, you know, each prisoner $29,000 a year. So there's a high human cost, of course, which is the most important thing factor in mass incarceration. But we're literally paying for that. You know, it does affect every Virginian. So for the $200 grand larceny, dishing out $29,000 a year, juvenile offenders, $150,000 a year. So it's just $15,000. That's just crazy.
It is crazy. And the whole system is crazy. It's crazy in Virginia. It's crazy in the United States. In the United States, in the beginning of the 1970s, I was just reading about this the other day. There was perhaps 350,000 people in American prisons. Within a decade, that number had risen to 1 million. And now we're at 2.3 million. The population of Richmond, where this rally is going to take place on Saturday, John, is 220,000. That's the capital of Virginia. The number of people in Virginia prisons, is 58,000. So you could take more than 25% of the entire population of the capital of the state of Virginia, that's Richmond, and that's 58,000 people. I mean, this is actually a criminal system. It's not a system to deal with crime. It's a criminal system. The prisons, in fact, become the crime. Because America has decided on a system of mass incarceration for minor offenses,
right.
Over-policing, especially in black and brown communities, but particularly poor and working class communities in general. And now you have a situation where the United States houses, not just in Virginia, but in aggregate numbers, one out of every four prisoners in the world is in a U.S. prison.
That's right. And we haven't even discussed the issue of solitary confinement, which Virginia uses and which the United Nations has declared is a form of torture.
Margaret, go ahead about that, if you would.
Yeah, well, we do have a case that was brought to our attention of a young man who's been in solitary confinement, and this isn't unusual, since 2013, in either short-term or long-term, but a constant state of solitary confinement since 2013. So when we heard about this case, looking into the issues of solitary confinement, you'll see the trend is going up. So that's the way we deal with. And I think this also speaks to the fact that the other trend that's going up in Virginia is a high rate of students with disabilities, and that's defined broadly with students with physical limitations, but also emotional issues. They're disproportionately more likely to be suspended or expelled. And Virginia is one of the states, as you know, where the student rate of detention for students is leads the country. So some put it at 50%. That was a study at Virginia Tech in the spring. And of course, this is disproportionately students of color. But see, a lot of times when you have prisoners being referred to solitary confinement, it's a fight. It's talking back to a guard.
Sure.
It's some sort of
insolence, they call it.
Yeah.
Insolence.
Margaret, we only have 90 seconds left. I'm looking at a Washington Post story about the headline is Inmates Blame Virginia Women's Prison for Deaths, Amputations. It's a picture of a woman on the top, Sherry Richburg. She's 63 years old, African-American woman. She had to have her leg amputated because of substandard care she received while incarcerated at the Fluvanna Correctional Center. And then this lawsuit shows that this was routine, in fact. Women prisoners, including people who are 70 years old, 60 years old, 65 years old, not getting medical treatment, having their legs amputated. I mean, again, the prison is, in fact, the crime. 1 minute. Go ahead. Talk about that, if you would.
Well, just in the broadly speaking, prisons are toxic environments, and it never gets talked about because there's no regulation for what goes on in prison, no regulation for the environment, no regulation for the healthcare. There's some minimum standards, but in speaking with prisoners, you know, you're not really getting the care. It's substandard care. So I'm getting reports from prisoners at Augusta Correctional, for example, where they are on water rations, because the other issue that you have is that these prisons are built now in the middle of nowhere where they don't have the capacity to deal with that population, their water, sewage. And so you get a high rate of respiratory illness. You get all sorts of things, but it's true from the spectrum of whether it's your prison environment or just your healthcare needs in general, they're not being addressed.
I'm sorry, we have to leave it there. We're completely out of time. I want to again encourage people to go to the Facebook page. This is the Richmond Rally for Prison Reform. We were joined from Richmond by Margaret Breslau, chairperson of the Coalition for Justice. Please stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
On the same day that he refused to answer questions before the House Intelligence Committee, former White House senior advisor Steve Bannon was subpoenaed to testify before Special Counsel Robert Mueller's grand jury. He has now reportedly agreed to an interview with Mueller rather than to testify before that grand jury. We'll look at whether Bannon is a witness or a target. We're joined from New York by Daniel Lazar. He's a journalist and author of The Frozen Republic, The Velvet Coup, and America's Undeclared War. Daniel, thanks for coming back on the show.
Thanks for having me.
Daniel, this story seems to change every couple of hours. Multiple subpoenas flying, whether they're from the House Intelligence Committee or from the Mueller group over at Justice. What exactly are we looking at here? Do we know yet if Steve Bannon is a target or a witness?
We have no idea. I mean, this whole thing is sort of petering out. It's changing shape, going off in different directions. It's really hard to figure out what's happening. And apparently Mueller is apparently Bannon is cooperating with the White House. They're consulting on strategy, legal strategy. So I have no idea what it means. I assume that Bannon doesn't know much, but I'm very skeptical of Russiagate from the start.
You're going to get no argument from us on that point. And I'm wondering, too, if a lot of this comes out of Michael Wolff's book. You know, Bannon made some very strong statements, and I wonder if Mueller thinks that there might be or could be something behind those statements that might take the form of evidence against somebody.
That makes sense to me. It certainly seems plausible, but I don't know anything more than that. I just know this whole thing is a sort of veering off strange directions. No one knows where it'll wind up. It's just all very strange.
And in fact, the press said today that this thing could bump right up to the 2018 congressional elections. And indeed, the Manafort Gates trial is most likely going to start, if there is a trial, in September or October, according to today's Washington Post.
It has its own life. And maybe
it really does.
And maybe that's the point. Mueller has a mission that's sort of the sky's the limit. I mean, he can go anywhere he wants. If he gets perjury charges, if he gets lying to the FBI, if he gets money laundering, which he's going after Manafort for, if he wants to talk to Steve Bannon about why he thought Donald Trump Jr., when he spoke to Michael Wolff, took a meeting with a Russian lawyer who came to America to talk about the Magnitsky Act, who did not have dirt on Hillary Clinton. But when Donald Trump Jr. Thought she did, he said, "I love it.
I love it."
And Steve Bannon said that was unpatriotic or maybe treasonous. It's sort of a rhetorical flourish. Yeah. He wasn't really quite saying that. But nonetheless, that would be enough then for Mueller to say, "Well, let's talk about that." And the thing just goes and goes and goes. I mean, it has its own life. I'm looking at NBC News from today. FBI agents visited Steve Bannon's home last week to discuss subpoena in Russia probe. I mean, why would that be absolutely necessary? FBI, I mean, it's not like he's a hidden figure.
Right.
FBI agents showed up. This is from NBC. FBI agents showed up at Steve Bannon's Washington home last week intent on serving him with a subpoena to appear before a grand jury investigating possible ties between President Donald Trump's campaign in Russia, according to sources familiar with the proceedings. The agents were unaware at that time that Bannon had retained Washington lawyer William Burke just hours earlier, according to two people familiar with the events that took place on January 9th. Once redirected, the agent sent the order to Burke, who is also representing two other witnesses in the probe being led by Special Counsel Robert Mueller, former director of FBI. And Daniel Lazar, as you pointed out, this thing, it just goes on and on. Nobody knows what it really is about. But I looked at The Nation magazine, the bastion of liberalism.
Right.
And the headline today was, the headline, the top feature of The Nation is right-wing, sort of vast right-wing conspiracy targets Mueller and the FBI, as if that's a grand danger to democracy. Now we have The Nation saying Mueller and the FBI are the guardians of liberty. I bet you if you look back at the last 50 years of Nation articles, I don't think you'd find anything where The Nation was instructing its liberal constituency to be all about defending the FBI.
Yeah, it's so damn strange. It's amazing. But no, but this has been going on for 15 months now. Ever since the election, and it'll keep on going on. I don't know, and I have no idea where it'll wind up. Just no one knows. It's changing shape, heading off in different directions. The whole Christopher Steele Simpson angle is becoming very interesting. But who knows? And meanwhile, The Nation has been all over the map. It's been skeptical of the investigation. It's been convinced there is a grand right-wing conspiracy to somehow, befoul the FBI. That's a great big ball of confusion.
Long live the FBI, the guardians of our freedom and democracy. I mean, it's pretty astonishing.
And liberals are really playing a fool's game.
Well, John Kiriakou and I were talking about this because when you look at, I mean, even though this is very titillating and people who, like in Washington or San Francisco or New York, are all about this. And I mean, people who are against Trump, and I'm, of course, against Donald Trump. I'm sure John Kiriakou,
we have
vast differences with his racist, xenophobic, misogynist, militaristic policies. But the fact of the matter is Donald Trump's approval ratings right now are going up. I mean, that's...
And the latest poll released today on realclearpolitics.com has him at 45%, which is strong.
Yeah. Meanwhile, Ben Cardin of the senator from Maryland, the Democratic senator from Maryland, has issued a white-hot anti-Russian report, which reads like something out of a HUAC from the 1950s.
It reads just like that. I mean, we were looking at it last week because we look for ourselves in the Cardin report. And sure enough, Sputnik, those of us in Sputnik, our radio shows are on the march. We are taking over. And the report showed it wasn't just America, John. We're taking over Europe.
Yeah.
Taking over Mexico, I think.
Mexico as well.
Of course. But as bad as Trump is, the Democrats are giving him a run for his money. They are actually outflanking him on the right, which is no small achievement. But they're doing it.
But it won't. But it's not a winning strat. If they think it's the line of least resistance and it's a good way to bring down Trump, I think it's a losing strategy for the Democrats because big parts of the country think this doesn't matter. It's not real. It's not true that Donald Trump became a thing not because of Sputnik or RT, but because CNN and CBS and ABC gave him so much, undiluted free media coverage during the 2016 campaign because he brought in good ratings. That's why, I mean, most Americans think that's why Trump became a thing. They don't think because RT or Sputnik or anything like that.
Well, whether or not it's good for Trump or good for the Democrats, it's very, very bad for the mass of the American people. Who are being dragged to the far right, by both hands, by the Democrats and the Republicans. So where will American society wind up when this whole process is finished? It's just Democrats should ask themselves, where are they going with all this?
But the problem is that the witch hunt fervor is so great. I mean, I was here at an event in Washington, D.C., and I was with other progressive people. I didn't really know them, but you know, if you talk to them, they all take it as the gospel truth that the Russians interfered. There's no doubt about it. All the intelligence agencies, they think, said that, even though there's been no hard evidence. And if you start to talk to them and argue about it, it's like arguing with a religious person about something that is indeed an article of faith. It's like talking about whether the Bible is literal and true with somebody who believes that the Bible is literally true.
Belief has become an end in itself.
You know, I was reading the comment section to the Washington Post article today about the arrest of this Chinese-American CIA officer. And I probably should never read the comments sections. They drive me crazy.
No, you shouldn't.
I shouldn't. I admit it.
It's not good for your
My
head.
Wife yells at me all the time. But, you know, in some ways, they're a microcosm. And somebody said, just factually, one sentence comment, there's a Chinese mole in the CIA. And then somebody immediately responded, there's a Russian mole in the White House.
Yeah, well.
And, you know, that's America.
I mean, you can say so many things about Donald Trump, but does anybody with their head screwed on straight really think he's a mole for Putin? Well, you know what? A lot of people actually now believe that.
A lot of people do. Yes, a lot of people really believe that. I mean, the guy's a lot of things, but a mole he ain't. You know, he's a whole long list of bad things you can say about Donald Trump. But one of the few that isn't on that list is Russian mole.
He couldn't even get business permits in Russia.
Precisely.
Can you imagine Donald Trump trying to conduct a surveillance detection route on his way to meet with his Russian handler? It would be comical.
No, he is the Manchurian candidate.
As the Steele memo, the Steele dossier does say at one point that the Kremlin was throwing real estate deals his way, and then a few pages later said that Donald Trump couldn't build a thing. And had to content himself with wild sex parties in St. Petersburg and Moscow.
Well, it's only gonna get worse and more gory.
He was the
and graphic,
agent of the Kremlin, but
here.
They wouldn't give him a business permit.
That's right. Well, we're gonna have to leave it there. We were joined from New York by Daniel Lazar. Daniel's a journalist and author of The Frozen Republic, The Velvet Coup, and America's Undeclared War. You've been listening to Loud and Clear. We're completely out of time. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking that page on Facebook. You can also hear us every day, Monday through Friday, from 4 to 6 p.m. on 105.5 FM and 1390 AM in the Washington, D.C. area. You can also hear us at SputnikNews.com and as a podcast at iTunes. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We'll see you next time.
Loud and clear. We'll be right back.